Why? This time the Sheikh's eyes actually brimmed with tears. He will beggar me. My wives and children will starve. El Shitan counsels you to enlarge the trade in gum kopal and copra, explained the interpreter in a sepulchral voice. And as your great closest ally, he promises to call you regularly with his great ship of many guns to make certain that you heed this advice.
Why?
The Sheikh plucked at his beard so that long curly hairs came away between his fingers. This ally makes one long for ordinary enemies. 24 hours later, Black Joke sailed into Telfer Bay, 40 miles further up the coast. Nobody had thought to warn the slaving fleet that was anchored there of the new policies of the state of Eilat, to which the territory now belonged. The 5 dhows in the outer anchorage managed to cut their anchor cables and slip away into the maze of shallow coral channels and shoals to the north of the bay, where Black Joke could not follow. However, there were another 6 smaller vessels on the beach and 4 magnificent double-decked ocean-going dhows lying in the inner anchorage. Clinton Codrington burned 2 of them and seized the 4 newest and biggest vessels, put prize crews into them, and sent them south to the nearest British base at Port Natal. 2 days later, off the beach at Kilwa, Clinton Codrington exercised his ship at gunnery practice, running out his 32-pounders and firing them in broadsides, which set the surface of the lagoon seething and dancing with foam and white fountains of spray. The thunder of gunfire burst against the far hills and rumbled back across the sky like cannonballs rolled across a wooden deck. The Sultan's local governor was reduced to a quivering jelly of terror by this display of might, and had to be carried bodily into the Black Joke's whaler to be rowed out to a conclave with the gunboat's captain. Clinton had the treaty forms already filled out and ready for signature when they carried the governor aboard to learn that he was heir to a kingdom to which he had never aspired, and a title which he knew was too grandiose not to bring with it certain retribution from somebody whose name he did not dare to breathe aloud. Admiral Kemp, sitting in his study in the magnificent mansion of Admiralty House, overlooking the wide smoky blue haze of the Cape Flats to the far mountains of the Hottentots, Holland, hopefully dismissed the first reports as the wild imaginings of some crazed subordinate who had served too long in the godforsaken outpost of Port Natal, and who was suffering from the bush madness of El Kafad that sometimes affects a person so isolated. Then the details began to arrive with every dispatch from the north, and they were too graphic to be lightly dismissed. An armada of captured prizes was arriving in the bay of Port Natal, 26 sizable dhows to date, some of them loaded with slaves. The Lieutenant Governor of Port Natal was desperate for the Admiral's advice as to what should be done with the dhows. The slaves had been taken ashore, released, and immediately been contracted as indentured labourers to the hardy and hopeful gentlemen who were attempting to raise cotton and sugarcane in the wilderness of the Umgeni Valley. The shortage of labour was critical. The local Zulu tribesmen much preferred cattle raiding and beer drinking to agricultural labour. So the governor would be delighted to receive as many freed slaves as the Royal Navy wished to send him. The admiral was not entirely certain of the difference between indentured labourers and slaves. However, what was the lieutenant governor to do with 26? No, the latest figure was 32 captured dhows. A further flotilla of 6 vessels had arrived as the governor was dictating his report. 2 weeks later, one of the captured dhows, which had been purchased into the colonial service by the lieutenant governor, arrived in Table Bay bearing a further batch of dispatches. One of these was from Sir John Bannerman, Her Majesty's consul on the island of Zanzibar. Another was from the Sultan of Omani in person, with copies to the Foreign Secretary in London and, quite remarkably, to the Governor-General in Calcutta. The Sultan evidently believed that as the representative of the Queen of England, the Governor-General would have some jurisdiction in the Indian Ocean, which was virtually his front garden. Admiral Kemp split the seals on both packets with a queasy feeling of impending gloom. "Good God!" he groaned as he began reading. And then, "Oh, sweet, merciful Jesus, no! And later, it's too much. It's like some sort of nightmare. Captain Codrington, one of the most junior post-captains on the Admiralty list, seemed to have taken powers unto himself which would have made a Wellington or a Bonaparte pause. He had annexed to the British Crown vast African territories which hitherto had formed part of the Sultan's dominions. With a high hand, he had negotiated with various local chiefs and dignitaries of dubious title and authority, pledging recognition and good British gold. Good God! The Admiral cried again in real anguish. What will that blighter Palmerston have to say? As a staunch Tory, Kemp had no great opinion of the new Whig Prime Minister. Since the troubles in India, the sepoy risings of a few years previously, the British government was very wary of accepting further responsibility for overseas territory and backward peoples. Their orders were specific, and Captain Codrington's recent activity went far from the essence of those orders. The scramble for Africa was still in the future, and the spirit of the Little Englanders motivated British foreign policy. Of this, Admiral Kemp was very painfully aware. Daunting as this was, yet it was far from the entire story, Kemp realised, as he read on into the consul's dispatch, his breath rasping hoarsely, his colour rising steadily, and his eyes behind the gold wire-framed reading glasses swimming with tears of rage and frustration. "When I get my hands on that puppy," he promised himself. Captain Codrington seemed to have declared single-handed war upon the Sultan. Yet even in his outrage, the Admiral felt a prickle of professional appreciation for the scope of his subordinate's operations. There was a formidable list of over 30 separate incidents recited by Her Majesty's Consul. The puppy had stormed fortified castles, raided ashore to burn and destroy barracoons, released tens of thousands of slaves, seized slaving vessels on the high seas, burned others at their moorings, and wrecked the kind of chaos worthy of a marauding Nelson himself. The Admiral's reluctant admiration for Codrington's technical conduct of the campaign in no way lessened his determination to exact vengeance for the disruption of his life and career that those actions presaged. "Nothing can save him this time. Nothing," the Admiral rumbled as he turned to study the Sultan's protest. This was obviously the work of a professional letter writer, and every paragraph began and ended with incongruous and flowery inquiries after Kemp's health, between which was sandwiched cries of anguish, screams of outrage, and bitter protest against the broken promises and treaties of Her Majesty's government. At the very end, the letter writer had not been able to resist adding a prayer for the Admiral and the Queen's prosperity and health in this life, and happiness in the one to follow. This detracted a little from the tone of injury in which the protests and demands had been couched. The Sultan assessed his losses as over 14 lakhs of rupees, almost a million of sterling, in plundered shipping and released slaves. And that did not take into account the irreplaceable damage to his prestige, nor the breakdown of the entire trade along the coast. The confusion was such that some ports might never again be opened to the trade. The system of gathering slaves in the interior of the continent and the network of routes to the coastal ports had been so sadly disrupted that they might take years to reopen, to say nothing of the gross shortage of shipping resulting from the depredations of El Shitan. Those ports still open to the trade were swamped with patient slaves, waiting for the dhows, which were already scattered wrecks upon the reefs and beaches of the Mozambique Channel, or sailing southwards under prize crews. "Nothing can save him," repeated Admiral Kemp, and then paused. His own career was finished also. He realised that, and he felt the deep injustice of it. For 40 years he had put not a single foot wrong, and his retirement was so close, so very close. He shook off the lethargy of despair and began to draft his orders. The first was to all ships of his squadron to detach immediately and to steam in search of Black Joke. In despair he realised that it might take as much as 6 weeks for his orders to reach his commanders, for they were scattered across two oceans. It might also take as long again for them to search out the errant gunboat in the maze of islands and bays along the Mozambique Channel. However, when they did so, Captain Codrington was to be relieved of his command with immediate effect. Lieutenant Denham was to take over as temporary commander, with orders to bring Black Joke into Table Bay as soon as possible. Admiral Kemp was confident that he could assemble sufficient senior officers on the Cape Station to convene an immediate court-martial. It might help his own position a little if he could report to the First Lord that a savage sentence had already been handed down to Codrington. Then there was a dispatch to Her Majesty's consul in Zanzibar suggesting he keep the Sultan reassured and quiescent until the situation could once more be brought under control, and until instructions could be forwarded from the Foreign Office in London regarding possible redress and compensation, although naturally at this stage no promises or commitments were to be given to the Sultan beyond expressions of good faith and commiseration. Then there was the onerous task of making his report to the Admiralty. There were no words to soften the actions of his subordinate and his own responsibility. Besides, he had been a serving officer too long to make any such attempt. Yet, when the bare facts were stated, even in the beloved unemotional jargon of the Navy, they seemed so magnified that Admiral Kemp was himself utterly appalled all over again. The packet boat was delayed 5 hours, while the Admiral completed, sealed, and addressed this missive. It would be in London in less than a month. His last dispatch was addressed to the officer commanding Her Majesty's ship Black Joke in person, and in it Admiral Kemp allowed himself to give expression to some of his own bitterness, taking a sour, sadistic pleasure in weighing the relative effectiveness of such words as corsair and pirate, or malicious and irresponsible. He had his little masterpiece of venom written out in 5 copies, to be disseminated in every direction and by every available means that might most speedily bring the puppy to heel. Yet when they were sent, all he could do was wait, and that was the worst part of the affair. Uncertainty and inaction seemed to corrode his very soul. He dreaded each new arrival in Table Bay, and whenever the signal gun on the hill above the town boomed its brief feather of gun smoke, his spirit quailed, and that sour ache of dread stabbed him in his guts. Each new dispatch lengthened the toll of destruction and depredation, until at last there was a report from the culprit himself, sewn up in a package of canvas and addressed to Admiral Kemp, delivered by the prize crew of a particularly valuable dhow over 80 feet long and of 100-ton burden. The tone in which Captain Codrington listed his achievements infuriated the Admiral as much as the deeds themselves. In an almost casual opening paragraph, Captain Codrington recorded the addition of some 1,000,000 square miles of Africa to the Empire. He had the grace to admit that his action may have exceeded his orders, and he explained away the discrepancy winningly. "It had been my firm intention to avoid scrupulously, whilst on this service, every act of a political nature. However, I was forced to accept the cessions of the kingdoms of Elat and Telfa by the entreaties of the Sheikh and the Imam, together with that of their people who seek refuge from the inimical and savage acts of the Sultan of Zanzibar." This was hard fare to serve their lordships, especially the First Lord, Lord Somerset, who had always grudged the use of his men and ships to fight against slavery. However, much worse was to follow. Captain Codrington went on to lecture the Admiral and to deliver a few homilies for their lordship's instruction. "By God's providence, an Englishman with no other force than the character of his noble nation has brought to these poor people salvation. Their lordships must pardon me for using an unfashionable argument," a sneer at the little Englanders. "However, it is as clear to me as the African sun that God has prepared this continent for the only nation on earth that has the public virtue sufficient to govern it for its own benefit, and for the only people who take the revealed word for their moral law." Admiral Kemp gulped as he read it, swallowed the wrong way, and was prostrated with a coughing fit from which he recovered some minutes later to read on. "In all the foregoing, I have been influenced by no personal motive or interest, by no desire of vainglory, but my endeavours have solely been to use the powers granted me to the honour of my God, my Queen, and to the benefit of my country and all mankind. The Admiral removed his reading glasses and stared at the glass case of stuffed songbirds on the wall opposite him. To write that, he is either the world's greatest fool, or a brave man, or both, he decided at last.